Welcome to Don't Be Scared, the podcast that helps you overcome imposter syndrome in life and career. This episode, I interview Dr. Chrissy McDowell, a scientist with an extensive research background in oncology, molecular biology, genetics, and many other sciences. Dr. McDowell shares her inspiring journey from cancer research to founding Baby Scientists, a nonprofit organization that educates and inspires children from underserved communities to pursue careers in STEM. In this first part of a two-episode special, yes, two y'all, Dr. McDowell talks about her educational background, research experiences, and the challenges she faced along the way. Tune in to learn how Dr. McDowell's passion, yes, y'all, passion for science led her to pursue a career in cancer research and how she is now inspiring the next generation of scientists. Hey, Dr. Chrissy McDowell. Just once again, thank you for joining me today. So grateful that you're here today. And just to share your experience and just to tell all the people and listeners what exactly you're doing in the community. And then just to learn a little bit about you. So before we get started, can you just give a one sentence summary about you? I'm going to put it to one sentence and see how you could do that.
One sentence. Oh, my goodness. Okay, I'm gonna hit you like this.
Okay.
I'm determined, I'm dedicated, and I'm passionate about what I do.
Love that. Determined, dedicated, and passionate. Three traits that I think are very, very great traits to have, especially in that case.
Yes.
Okay, so let's get into it. So let's start off with just, can you tell the audience just as far as your background, as far as where you grew up? Let's just start there. Like, how'd you grow up? And then from there, where did you like sciences?
Yeah, for sure. Okay. So I am an Okie from Muskogee, Oklahoma. Okay. You know, that's an old school country song. I was born in Muskogee, Oklahoma. We moved to Norman, Oklahoma when I was in middle school. And so that's where I primarily grew up, in Norman. My mother is a social worker. Well, she's retired now, but she is a retired social worker. She's in mental health. That's her area of expertise, mental health. And so my older sister, when it was time for her to go to college, my mother accepted a position at the University of Oklahoma as a professor of social work. And so that's what made our move to Norman. And so I grew up there, went to Washington University in St. Louis. I did my undergrad there. After that, I matriculated to Meharry Medical College, and that's a historically Black medical school, graduate school. It's only graduate. It only gives out graduate degrees, PhDs, MDs, and dental degrees, and some master's degrees. And so from there, I did a postdoc in the University of Michigan, and I also did a postdoc at the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration. And so my area of expertise is primarily molecular biology, cancer biology, infectious diseases. My technical degree, you know, the department that I was under was microbiology and immunology. So okay. I always tell my students, I failed microbiology and in undergrad and got a PhD in it in in graduate school. So anything's possible.
Yeah, but, no.
Yeah. Yeah. So my interest in science started in high school. I always was an inquisitive person by nature. That's what my mother tells me.
Yeah.
And so one year, I think it was my sophomore year in high school, or maybe my junior year. yeah, my junior year in high school, I was in the library and I was somehow interested in science. And I started talking to one of the librarians and about my interest. And she was like, "Oh, really? My husband is the director of the microbiology department at OU." And I was like, "Really?" I was like, and she was like, "Yeah, I'll introduce you to him and maybe you can work with him." And so that actually happened. So Dr. Beavers is his name. He was the director of the microbiology department at the University of Oklahoma. And I worked with him for 2 summers and in his laboratory. And it was one of the best experiences of my life. And from there, you know, I decided after the first summer I worked with him, I went home and told my mother, I said, "I know what I'm gonna do with my life. I'm going to get a PhD in microbiology and I'm going to find the cure for AIDS." And I remember that so vividly. I was sitting in a recliner at home and she was like, okay, that's good. Sounds good. Sounds like a good plan." And so, you know, half of it's come true, you know, yeah. I got my PhD in microbiology. I haven't discovered the cure for AIDS, but I did do some AIDS research in undergrad. And so, So that's how, you know, it started. Like I said, my mother was a professor. And so education was important. It was big in our household. And at one point in time, you know, my mother was working on her PhD. And, you know, all of us were at home doing homework, you know, me, my mother, my sister. And so it was just, you know, understood that, you know, education is important. You're going to go to college, get a degree, you know, and support yourself and be independent. And so that never was an issue for me. However, that's why I'm so passionate about going into our communities and educating our kids about the possibilities of science and STEM, because I know everybody doesn't have or didn't have the support and foundation, educational foundation that I had, which I now realize was so crucial. And it was just, you know, it was just second nature, you know, for me. It never was a question as to and I've always been a motivated person. That's just, you know, how I am. I always wanted to be great. I always wanted to do great things. Always wanted to be the best in everything I did. And so I was just kind of, that's just kind of, you know, part of me, you know, I was born with that drive. And and I still have it to this day. And, you know, it's a good thing and a bad thing. It's like, you know, you're constantly working and driving, but then you're always like, "Oh, I could do better." You know, I'm not doing enough. I'm not where I want to be, you know? So it's like, you know, it's a good thing and a bad thing. You know, you're driven, but, you know, you're also very critical of yourself. And I guess part of that is being a Virgo too. So,
I got to break down something, because the key word, the thing that I'm thinking about is exposure. Mm-hmm. When you said that, because you said that in high school, right, you actually did research at a university.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Microbiology for a whole professor, you know, that, and that's rare for people that don't understand, you know, to be in high school and do this type of research. Yeah. And your exposure at that young age kind of transformed where you was going to be today. You know what I'm saying? Because imagine if you didn't do that.
Right.
It would be a whole different outcome. So that's amazing, that just that exposure, you know what I'm saying, at that young age. I'm curious about, so one thing I'm curious about, and I always like to see is, you know, sometimes we like to be in our comfort zones, right? Mm-hmm. And you took a leap and you left your comfort zone because you went to Washington. Yeah. Right, Washington University out there, and from Oklahoma, and to leave, you know what I'm saying, your home state or where you were born and raised. So what made you leave, you know, and just go to that university in particular too?
Yeah. You know, I told you, it's just always been in me to explore and want to find new things and find out different things and see how other things work. I just knew that I wanted something outside of Oklahoma. I wanted something different than Oklahoma, what they could provide. You know, I pretty much grew up on the campus of OU, you know, being around there. And it was like, this is cool, but I want something different. And so I and Norman is and well was and still is primarily white. So I wanted to be around more black folks because that's another thing that was big in my household was, you know, pride in yourself, pride in your culture, you know, black pride, learning about our history. That's another thing that my mother taught us was to learn about our history, you know. And so I knew about black scientists. We had my mother had gave me flashcards, and I still have them to this day. It's like 100 flashcards of black scientists.
That's dope.
And so, you know, I knew there were other things and other opportunities that I wanted to explore. And so I applied to Howard University, Boston University, Washington University. And the reason why I chose Washington University, it wasn't even on my radar. My mother told me to apply. And I was just like, okay, you know, because she said some doctor that she worked with, some psychiatrist that she worked with, attended Washington University and it was a good school. So I was like, okay, I'll apply. Right. And that's another reason why I went to Meharry, because while Meharry was on my radar through my mother, she said the doctor that brought me into this world was a graduate of Meharry Medical College. And so that's how I knew about that HBCU. And so so those were three four schools. And of course I applied to the University of Oklahoma and I was accepted into all of them. And my deciding factor was money, which one was giving me the most money, the most grants, and financial aid. And so, Washington University, provided me with the most, money. And so that's how I ended up in St. Louis. And, it was one of the best experiences, that I've had. You know, a lot of my, peers, that I went to school with, I'm still, you know, still interact with through Facebook and other things, which is awesome. And you know, I used to consider St. Louis like my second home. But yeah, I wanted to get away. I wanted to see and experience other people and other cultures and you know, and experience some diversity, you know. But unfortunately, Washington University wasn't very diverse, you know. It was more the same. But you know, you know, I gravitated because, you know, I'm black through and through. And so I gravitated to my black folks. And so that's who I primarily hung out with and was friends with. You know, I, of course I'm open and I welcome everyone, but you know, you want to be with your people. And so, you know, most of my friends and everyone that I interacted with were black, and you know, I was involved in the Association of Black Students. I was on the executive board, and just you know, in doing a lot of other extracurricular activities, in college. But yeah, so and it was great. It was great, and I really I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it, and it was great to be around a lot of smart black people. Right, because in my high school, it was me and one of my best friends, Ernestine. We were the two smart black people, you know, in my school, because my high school was only 3% black. And so we were the two in AP and you know, those type of courses and stuff. And so it was good to be around other smart black people and you know, your peers and to learn and grow from them. And then you know, other people from different states, you know, it's like, oh wow, you know, because being from Oklahoma, you know, I found that I was in the minority when it came to mac and cheese, right? Because we didn't eat mac and cheese growing up.
And
And
for real?
for real, man,
Whoa,
my family or what? But when I got to college, I was like, what is this fascination with mac and cheese?
It's
I mean,
so good. It's so
It
good,
is good. It is good, you
though.
know, if the right person cooks it. But
You're right.
yeah, you know, at our family gatherings, you know, during the holidays, mac and cheese was not on the table and it was never on the menu. And so it wasn't until I got to college that I learned the black folks' love and fascination with baked mac and cheese.
It's like, hey, you gotta have that at Thanksgiving. If you don't got it, what you doing? That's how it was here. Okay. So I got a question for you. With the a couple of questions with your undergrad experience, I'm curious about, but the one as far as this the main deciding factor you mentioned was money. What in particular What about WashU was making you like, what do they offer you? Or because I always get this question, like, what type of package should you be looking for, right? When you go to apply to these schools, and then when they do offer you these packages, how do you decide that? What were your deciding factors in this case with the money?
Yeah, it was how much grant money they were giving me and scholarship money. And at the time, WashU was one of the most expensive schools, you know, back that was 90, 92. I went to it was my freshman year, and the tuition was $24,000. And you know, that's like the $80,000 now, you know, that students
Yeah.
have. So it was really expensive. And so I'd say over half of the tuition was grants and scholarships,
Okay.
academic scholarships, and then another portion was loans.
Okay.
And but it well no it was more than 50%. It was more like maybe 75, 80, because I know my mother paid, she probably paid like $2,000, $2,500 a semester. And because I ended up after those 4 years only having $30,000 in loans,
Oh, wow.
so the
Okay. Yeah,
majority
that's good.
was grants and scholarships. And yeah, and mom, like I said, my mother paid like 2,000, 2,500 a semester. And so that was it. You know, unfortunately, I really wanted to go to Howard because I really wanted to be around, you know, I really wanted the Black experience, to be around more Black people and be around the culture.
Yeah.
But they were slow in providing me that information, and as far as financial aid and also housing, you know, I didn't even know where I was going to stay. So I was sad about that, but I got over it. Because
Yeah.
you know, I had to make a decision.
Yeah, no, of course. Had to make it at the end of the day. And then whoever's, in this case, whoever gets the most, you know what I'm saying? That's definitely a big factor. I did the same thing myself. So what was it like, what I'm saying, being out there? Because you got out there, and then you realize, like, oh, this is very similar to where, I come from with Norman. How was your experience like in the classrooms, but also just and overall the campus, the culture of the campus? How was that being at a
The camp,
CWI? Yeah.
it was a microcosm of the world. That's what it was. We had our battles as Black students. A lot, I'd say maybe at least 50% of the student population was Jewish. And
Whoa.
so you know, that was also different, being around a lot of students with that were rich. You know, these students are driving cars and having money more than my mother had, you know what I'm saying? So you see a parking lot and it's full of, you know, high-end cars. It's like, wow. And so and they were this is when I learned that they want to take from you, but they don't want to give to you. So in our classes, you know, when we organic chemistry, the bio courses, you know, they were tough. And these are the classes where it's like 300 people in the classroom. The professor talks to the chalkboard, and you don't, and so you have to seek out tutors and things of that nature. So, and so that's what I did. And so I would always have these students come up to me on my floor of my dorm asking me, oh, did you go see a tutor? Did you get help with this problem set? Did you get help with this homework? And it's like, yeah, I did, you know? And so I would help them, you know, first couple of times. But then when I went to them for reciprocity, you know, there was none. And I'm like, well, hold up, wait a minute. You know, I'm like, I just helped you. Why you can't reciprocate the deed? And so I was like, okay, you want to take, but not give. And so that was, I learned that early. That was like my freshman year. That was my freshman year. And so you know, we had to, you know, fight to be seen on campus, to be heard. We were, you know, because a lot of the students, Black students, they were determined, and they were fighters, and they had drive, and they didn't sit back and allow the administration to just say and do anything. We always challenged the administration. We always challenged the norms, and so to make our voices heard. And so, I love that about my campus and the Black student body, that no one was complacent, and just settled for, what we were given. We always fought to be heard, to be seen, and to to have equal rights and equal say on what goes on campus. So.
Yes. Yeah. That's very interesting. It seems like it seems like the same situation, unfortunately, at every type of school. Whenever I talk to somebody who they got similar experiences to where it's just like you're not being heard, or there's always a fighting going on against it. So that's very interesting. And I guess I'm wondering what made you go to the HBCU for your grad school in this case, because I was like the opposite. I went to HBCU for my undergrad, and then I decided, okay, let me switch it up and go to a PWI for my grad school. But you were like reverse. So what made you go to your HBCU in Meharry?
So to keep it 1,000,
Please do. Yeah.
my GPA was garbage.
Okay.
Meharry gave me an opportunity, I took the GRE, and I think my score was so-so, but I wasn't a disciplined student when it came to studying. And, it was because in high school I didn't have to study. I did my work, I did well on it, because I had all A's, and I got my last B, the last semester of my senior year, because I had senioritis in high school. So I didn't have to study too hard, and so I had bad study habits. And so I didn't study a lot in undergrad, and so I ended up, I think my GPA was like a 2.9, 2.9, like a C average. And so like I said, my GRE wasn't that great. And so, I mean, my GRE was so-so. It was okay. It was like middle of the pack. It wasn't like outstanding or anything. And so, and I didn't apply to any other grad schools.
Okay, so this was the only one?
That's the only one. I only applied to Meharry. I said, I'm gonna see if I get into Meharry first. If I get into Meharry, then, I'm rolling. And I did. And so they gave me an opportunity, even though my GPA wasn't the greatest and everything, they gave me an opportunity, and I took it. And like I said, I knew about them, and I did my research on them because of what my mother told me about the doctor who birthed me, the gynecologist. And so that's why I chose Meharry. And so it was definitely different,
Yeah, I can
it was
imagine.
because I was used to going to class in sweats and t-shirt and jeans and a ball cap, and everybody up in there dressed to the nines. I'm like, really? That's what they do? We dress up going to class? I wasn't ready for it. I wasn't ready for it. I was a fish out of water. And so, I had to step my game up a little bit, but my funds were too tight. I couldn't afford it. And I did feel like somewhat of an outsider when I got there, because primarily everyone that was there, and I'm speaking about in the PhD programming, it's not everybody in the medical school part, because it's they're much bigger than we were. Not everybody went to an HBCU undergrad, but the majority did. And I swear, like 80 to 90% of the students went to HBCU's undergrad. So this was,
That's interesting.
So I was truly an outsider, in my own home. And so, and then the other part of being an outsider was I was in Greek.
No, okay.
A lot of the students in my class were Greek, and so that too made me an outsider. And so it was different. And then on top of that, I am gay. So that was another reason that made me an outsider. So I had so it was those three things. So the HBCU experience was a little more challenging than
Okay.
the PWI.
Okay.
Yeah, but thank goodness, I'm confident and secure in who I am.
Yeah.
And so, it was a little disappointing that I wasn't on the inside, with a lot of my homegirls and stuff, but it was okay. I may do, because my focus in grad school, I decided to flip the switch and was like, okay, I BS'd around in undergrad. I'm gonna do better in grad. And so I made that commitment to myself, and I said, I'm going to make the dean's list in graduate school. I'm gonna make this change, Michael Jackson, man in the mirror, and so I did. And so I did. I made the dean's list for my first 2 years. Well, that's the only 2 years you do coursework. And so I was happy and proud of myself, for that. And so that was part of the experience. And see, my experience was also different in that my mentor died,
What?
halfway through graduate school. So, and the other thing, so yeah. So we know HBCUs have been historically underfunded. And so same thing with Meharry. And our stipends that we got were less than $1,000 per month,
Move.
and yeah, man, it was struggle city. And
How
so,
did you? I'm
man,
very curious. Yeah.
I took out a small loan. We were able to take out a smaller loan, like a few $1,000s, and then I had to get a job. They didn't want us to work. We're not supposed to work because they're
Yeah.
paying us, but it's like I'm getting $900 and my rent is five,
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? How am I
Yes.
supposed to survive? So I had to work a little part-time job, and so that was a challenge in itself. But a lot of the investigators, the scientists whose labs we could work in, they were underfunded. They didn't have money, and so I was hearing stories about people being in, taking 8, 9, 10 years to get their PhD, and I said, "Oh hell no, it shall not be me." So they were like, "Well, we do collaborate with Vanderbilt because Meharry's in Nashville, Tennessee," and they're like, "We collaborate with Vanderbilt, so you can go up to Vanderbilt and work with investigators up there." So that's what I did. I did rotations at Vanderbilt and found a black, like one of the only black scientists up there. He was an MD, but and so I started doing my dissertation research with him. And 2 years, yeah, 2 years into the game, he died of colon cancer. And so, yeah, so I was left without a lab for almost a year. I sat out of school for almost a year. That was a dark time for me, But, my mother's a social worker. I know about mental health, so I did seek help, get therapy. Did I was on an antidepressant for a while because it was like hindering my goals, and I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm not going to be able to accomplish my goals. I came here and everyone was telling me, oh, just get a master's degree, you've done enough, you can get a master's, and I'm like, I'm better than a master's degree. Not that master's degrees aren't good, I have a space, but I didn't come there for a master's. I came there for a PhD. And so my dean told me, she was like, well, you can, because we collaborate and get grants from the NIH, National Institutes of Health, you can do research with scientists there. So I was like, bet. So I got online, and because I was in cancer research at the time, and so I looked up some scientists on the National Cancer Institute website. I went through the whole list of all the scientists and read their research, and I emailed like 10 or 15 people and told them who I was, what my situation was, and that I was looking for a lab to finish my dissertation research. And I got responses from maybe a third of them, and then I got an invite from one to come up and do a presentation, and so he let me come and finish my work in his lab. And I started completely over. All the work that I had done those first 2 years was gone. And there was no one to take up the slack. There was no one. He didn't have any like collaborators in the department that could I whose lab I could go to and finish my work. So I left Nashville and went to Frederick, Maryland, where that's where the National Cancer Institute research labs are. And a part of them. And man, it's glorious being in an area where there's money. You know, when money's not an issue, man, life is grand. And so I finished my dissertation research in a year and a half.
What?
Half, yes.
What? Okay, hold on, hold on. I gotta break down some things here. Because one thing I want to break down is just what in your mind clicked, right? Because there were several mind shifts that you had to do from how you went to undergrad to grad school, and you recognized, right, that you had to look in the mirror, so you realized it was all on you. Then you could have easily just stopped what you're doing, got the master's, and just dipped out. But there was a mind shift that you had to go through, right, to go and seek out. So what was that? Because it's like a hunger. Like what was that hunger? What how can you describe that to somebody who's looking for that type of feeling?
You have to look deep inside of yourself and ask yourself, what do I want? What are my goals? And how am I going to get there? How am I going to attain it? By any means necessary, you have to be willing to be flexible and to be malleable and to do what it takes. That's the bottom line. You do what it takes to, to get to your end goal. And that's what I was willing to do. And you can't be afraid of fear, right? Sure, I was fearful, right? It's like, oh my gosh, going to, because Frederick, Maryland is right outside of DC. So it's a whole different, area, different people, it's a different vibe, out here from Oklahoma to Nashville to the DMV. And so you have to know thyself, you have to know yourself, and you have to push yourself. You can't be afraid to push yourself. You can't be afraid to go outside of your comfort zone, and you can't be afraid to go outside of the boundaries, because if you don't, then you'll never be satisfied with yourself, really. Because it's all about me. It ain't about what other people think, about what other people are doing. It's about me and yourself. And it's like, I have to do this for me. This is what I want. And this is what I'm willing to do. You can't be afraid to work hard. You can't be afraid of failure, And so it is just a drive that you have to have inside your gut, and that pushes you regardless of what goes on. And it's like, and you have to understand that, it's a marathon, not a sprint. It's a marathon, not a sprint. And so, and in that race, it's going to be hills and valleys. And so you have to have endurance. You have to build up that endurance to get over those hills and to grind through those valleys. And you'll get to the top, and you'll reap some success. But there's a lot of ups and downs. And so yeah. And the other thing was, it's like, I'm going to an area that's like double the cost of living, from Nashville to Maryland, and I'm still only getting like $1,000 on $1,100. So I had to live. I end up moving in with a family from a church, and renting out their room. Well, I didn't rent it. They gave it to me for free, So I was living with a white family, in Frederick, Maryland, and finishing up my PhD. So I was just faced with all kind of adversity and challenges, and it's and then I'm going into a laboratory. It's not undergrad, I mean graduate students there. It's all postdocs and above.
I mean, that's another crazy thing. It's like you went to a national lab, and if you don't understand national labs, it's like this, as you mentioned, no grad students, no undergrads. This is full-time employees or postdocs. That's it. This is what they do. So it's like, you know what I'm saying? You going into that environment, and now that I think about it, that was another case of exposure. And you could argue that was kind of, in some weird way, it was like it was meant to be, and because it's like, being in that environment. So I guess I wonder, so you finish and you're ecstatic. What do you do after, now that you are finished?
Postdoc, I considered, pharmaceuticals because, the thing is, you want this degree, you want to do the research, but you also want to make money, right? And it's like, can I skip my postdoc and get a position at a pharmaceutical company? And I think I applied to a few jobs, but to no success. So I went ahead and took a postdoc. Oh, excuse me. In Michigan, at the University of Michigan Cancer Center, Cancer Center in Ann Arbor. And so I was there for 2.5 years. And see, the other thing, right, about being at the national lab at the National Cancer Institute, you still the thing about and the thing about me is, like, even though I grew up in an all-white area, I'm always aware of my blackness and who around me is black or not black. I'm always aware, have always been aware. And so that's part of my drive for Baby Scientists, my nonprofit. So, because I'll take this back to undergrad right quick. I did research. I sought out research in as an elective in undergrad, and I also did work study in a research lab. And I tell you, going into those buildings, they had a brand new facility. It was nice. And this was just the building I was working in. I was cleaning up jars of fruit flies and stuff. It was a nasty job, but it paid well. So that's why I did it. I wasn't afraid of nastiness or the mess or whatever. But yeah, it was a genetics lab. And when I walked into that building, everything was white. The walls, the floors, the door handle. It's like everything is white. Oh my God. Can they have some color up in here? And at the time, it didn't dawn on me, but that has stuck with me. That has been imprinted in my brain that everything was white, including the people. And even though they are from different countries, a lot of them, it still weren't any people from, Africa or any other countries with, people of color, India. It might have been a few Indians there or whatnot, but it was still, primarily white. And it's just like, I'm the only little black thing walking through here. And same thing, at Vanderbilt when I was working there. In those halls, there weren't a lot of black people. We were considered the black lab, because the principal investigator, he was black, like I said, but it was me and one other black student. And then everybody else in the lab was white. So I'm like, how are we a black lab just because there's three people? But, and that's another thing. I know I'm going all over, but they don't call labs that are all Indian, Indian labs, or all Chinese, Chinese labs, but we had the label of black lab, and it's like, why does it have to be a negative thing? Why can't it be a positive thing? It's a positive thing because and that's where I learned every other culture, and I've seen that they help them each other. They employ each other. They give each other. That's why you go in a lab and it's majority Chinese. The head person, male or female, will be Chinese, and everybody working underneath them be Chinese. Or Indian. Whether what part of India doesn't matter. They all Indian up in there. So I saw that. And so when I went to the National Cancer Institute, it was more diverse, right? But I was still the only black person walking around pretty much the whole building.
What's the whole?
I mean, it's because my the PI, he was from Switzerland. Another guy was from, it was an Indian guy. He was Indian, but he was from Germany. It was a guy from France. It was another lady. She was from Egypt, but she was the lighter version. She wasn't very brown. And then it was a Caucasian lady. She was our technician. And then we end up with a Chinese guy and another Indian guy. And then all the labs were like that. It was like people from all over Europe, and Asia. In these buildings, and it's just no black people, no Africans, and no people from no black Americans. I was like, I mean, the entire building. So I'm sitting in meetings, the only little black thing up in there. And so that's what motivated my drive It's like I have to get more Black people in these labs in research and science because I can't be the only one, you know. And but my peers are experiencing the same things wherever they are, you know, and whether
Yeah.
it's or whatever, they're the only ones. And so, and I call it the lonely only, you know, the lonely
Okay.
only,
The
you know.
lonely
And
home.
yeah, and always the lonely only up in there. But you know, you can't allow that to deter you from your goals and from your mission. You
Yeah.
know, it just has to be, you know, part of your motivation. It can't be all your motivation because it ain't everything ain't about race and color. It's
Yeah.
about you and you becoming great in what you do in your craft. And so, but you know, you have to stay aware because racism exists. And even though these people aren't American, they have adopted, you know, some of the ideals about Black people that these you know, white people have, you know,
Yeah.
race have put upon us, that we're lazy, that we don't work as hard. And so, you know, it wasn't the lazy thing for me, it was the trust factor. So I as a graduate student found a novel, came up with d discovered a novel thing in the research that we were doing because we were studying the cell cycle,
Okay.
and we were studying mice, and we were using mice to as a an instrument, and we were looking at the cell cycle, and I discovered that some particular protein interacted with another protein that no one had seen before or known.
Okay.
And so my PI, he was like, "Oh, this is nice, this is good." And he was like, "How did you do this? How did you come up with this?" And I'm like, "Dude, what you mean how? I'm up in this piece with y'all every day. You know, you see me grinding it out. What are you talking about?
Yeah.
It's like you see me in the lab working. I'm bringing you my Western blot, you know, showing you what's what." And
Yeah.
it's like science doesn't lie. But he didn't necessarily believe it. He didn't believe my work. And so my work from graduate school didn't get published. And you know how
What?
important publishing is.
Yeah.
You know, he as a Swiss man, it has some, you know, idea about Black people that we can't be as smart, or we're not as smart, or we can't do certain work that, why? Homie, I'm up in here with you. You know, I'm
Yeah.
up here with you. You know, like what? And so that was really disappointing. That he didn't write up my work and publish it. But a postdoc, she came up with something similar. She found something similar. Oh, that's great. This is a novel. This is a great. Her work got written up, but mine didn't. And people are like, "Oh, Christy, you should push, you should try, you should, you know, you should write it yourself." I'm like, that's his layup. You know, if even if I write it
Yeah.
up, there's no determined, you know, fact that he will really publish it. That's
Yeah.
him. It's his lab. It's his work. I can't force him to publish, you know, something that he doesn't believe in. But you know, it is what it is. I defended my work and got my PhD. And like I say, you know, and I don't know if it's because I did it so fast, because like I said, a year and a half of a whole of your, all your dissertation, it's unheard of. And people don't normally do that, but I had so much. It was so much money, and it was nothing to get your supplies and stuff. And we had technicians, a couple of technicians that you know, bred our mice and brought us our mice. We just tell them what we needed. They breed the mice, get them to us, and everything. So you know, it flowed. You know, it flowed. It was nice. And so you know, I dealt with that. You know, I was like, gosh, I never really felt racism directly
Yeah.
until. You know, but it still wasn't as direct as it was when I got to the FDA. But you know, I just let it go. That bothered me for a while.
Yeah.
But I let it go because you know, you got to keep pushing. You can't let, you know, one person's idea or thoughts about you hinder you from what your goals are and what you're trying to do.
Exactly. And I'm glad you brought that because I want to transition to how you got into FDA. We talked a little bit about that. But one comment I just want to make about that whole situation is just to let everybody know, right? We talked about HBCUs are underfunded. Let's think about if they didn't have to worry about money. Because think about your situation. You are a star, but the funding and everything slowed you down. right? And then as soon as you got into a position, you were able to do so much work in a year. That's just, it's mind-blowing to me. So it's like when people don't understand how much funding is, it's so important because it gets rid of so many problems that you can focus on new problems,
That's right.
right? So it's that's just so critical. But okay, so you finish your PhD, you get that done, and then you go to FDA, and now I want to just talk about, why you're, because this is a big thing, you're into doing the research that you want to do, you always wanted to do. How is that experience getting into industry? Because one of the main goals coming from our community is like everybody's pursuing this industry type of job because it's more money, right? And it's a more safe, you could say, you know what I'm saying, more benefits. But what is the environment actually like, you know what I'm saying, once you actually get there?
Man, it's same-ish, different day, different location. Lonely only up in that piece, you know. Black people that you see, they working in a cafeteria, you know, or janitorial services. You know, that's what I experienced in undergrad, that, you know, the black people aren't in the classrooms teaching. They are serving us, you know, or the janitor service. That's what I experienced at the FDA also. And so I did a postdoc slash fellowship at the FDA for almost 6 years prior to becoming a full-time employee. And so that was a good experience. I enjoyed it a lot. That's when I started, when I transitioned from cancer research to more infectious disease research. And so I enjoyed it a lot. And that's when I saw again, the like cultures helping each other, because here I am. It was like four of us postdocs, and it was a white girl, well, white woman, me, and an Indian guy. And so I was the longest one there. I was the last Mohican in the crew. I was the first one to get there and the last one to leave to get a full-time job as in the FDA. He got his Indian connection, got him in the lab for a full-time job. Her white connection got her in a lab for a full-time position. And so I was the last one there, and I was applying on USA Jobs, and nothing. And that's also when I learned it's about networking. It's about who you know and not necessarily what you know. And I've seen it with my own eyes, because both of them knew people, and those people got them in. And I mean, it happened to me too, because luckily the white girl came back for me and got me. And she and I weren't the best of friends. It was just, you know, she was, you know, looking out. And so she, once she got her job and was there for like a year, she told, they had a position open up, and she told the director about me. And so I had a conversation with the director, and all was good. I went in for an interview. They were like, okay, cool, now apply for the job. Right, so you apply after the interview. So I applied and I got accepted, and so I got in, and I was like, yes, oh my God, I finally made it. You know, because, you know, it's up here in the DMV. You want that, they call it a good government job. You know, security, like you say, it's benefits. You know, you start out with a good salary because you know you're already a PhD. So you starting out on, you know, because the scale is GS. It's like a GS scale from 1 to 15. And so because I'm a, excuse me, PhD, I start out at GS 13. And so, you know, I started out making 90,000. And so I was like, yeah, you know, I'm getting close to my goal, you know, because that was always my goal, to make over that type of money. And so I was happy, and I was like, and I'm surrounded by all PhDs, you know, because I got a job in the division of microbiology. And so we reviewed applications from pharmaceutical companies that produce generic drugs and new drugs. drugs and generic drugs. And so we reviewed their applications as microbiologists for sterility of the process of making those drugs. And so we would get an application, 1,000 pages, right? And so you're reviewing this, we're reviewing the labels. We have to review the labels, what they put on the labels, what the ingredients, their expiration date, how they made it, what equipment they used to make it. We reviewing their calculations, the calculations of how they, made the drug and what facility they used, all of that. We review all that as microbiologists. Now, but most of and so this now took me away from research and gave me a desk job. And so this was different. It was definitely different. And to be honest, I really didn't like it. It was cool. The overall thing was like, wow, we really control, we really have control in what drugs go to the market, that what get made, from what we say, and we also test the efficacy of the drugs as well. So, we had a big role in saying, what drugs go to market and what don't. But the process of it, sitting at your computer all day looking at, files and files and files, that was boring as hell. And I was like, oh my God, I have to get up out this piece, right? That's what I was thinking. And because I wanted to be, I was like, so I started researching what other positions you could have as a microbiologist and reviewing drugs and stuff. And so, going out into the field, there were, you go out into the field and do and evaluate in that way. And I was like, I'm there, right? So, but little old me being naive, thinking that everything was gonna be good and copacetic. I'm here with all PhDs, right? And I was the only Black American. There were a couple of Africans that were maybe one there, and then a couple other came in with my class of hiring class. And so 3 weeks after being there, so it was a Hispanic lady. She was Mexican, from Mexico. She told me about her family in Mexico and all that type of stuff. She was like my trainer, right? I went and discussed, and she was showing me, how to review these applications and things of that nature. So I had meetings with her, a couple of meetings a week. And this lady went to the director after 3 weeks and told her that she didn't believe I could do the job. And I was like, huh? I mean, this lady blatantly lied on me. I had never experienced anything like that in my life. Like, huh? She went to the director and told her I was canceling meetings, I wasn't following through with stuff, and she didn't think that, I would be able to do the job that I was doing well, and that I could do the reviews of these applications. She didn't think that I could do the job. She didn't think I was capable. And I was like, huh? And so then, here I am getting called into the director's office, asked what's going on, and I'm like, I said, I've never canceled a meeting with her. I said, one of our trainings went late and I needed to eat lunch. And so I just asked to push our meeting back 30 minutes so that I could get lunch. I said, I've never canceled a meeting with her. And as far as doing the work, I said, I've been doing it. I don't understand what the problem is. And so from that day forward, I had a black cloud over my head, and everything that I did was scrutinized to the T. And from my attendance, it's like, where were you at this time? We called your office and you weren't there. I went to go get lunch, or I was in someone else's office talking about, my application. I was getting help with something, so they were on me like bad. And in the government, you have a year probation, and in that first year, they can fire you for anything. So you have to get past that first year in order to be secure. And I saw that I wasn't going to make it past that first year because they were on me, and they started documenting every little thing that they thought was wrong or questioning me about stuff. And it really was disheartening. I was just like, I can't believe this. I was like, finally, I got where I want to be, and I'm experiencing this. Like, oh my God, what the heck? And it's like, once again, you're the only, there's no other higher up Black people executives that I could go to and talk to about this, because there are none, and there are a few other Black people in working in different departments and divisions, but and I had a couple of people that I could talk to, but there's no one that could help me. It's like I'm out there by myself. And so I went to the EEO office, and that's one thing, Black folks, we all up in the EEO and HR offices always, And so, I found solace there. I can go there and chill and vent and but the thing was is like they like you have a case, but if you do file, it'll be a blemish on your record.
If you file against the person who's doing all this against you and putting this black cloud over you, you can't do anything. Because it's going to be, wow.
And then they were like, and then if you get fired, you really ain't gonna get no other government job,
And
right?
then explain that for me, as far as if you,
So if I tried to stay, because I was really close, I was like 10 and a half, 11 months in the game. And I felt the pressure. I felt the pressure coming on me. Like they were gonna, fire me. And so I was like, so 9 months in, I was like, you know what? Let me do a detail and get out of here. And I'll be in a detail while my year is up. And so when I come back, I can avoid getting fired like that. Because in the government, you can go to another agency or another division and train for like a month or 2 months or 3 months. And so I'd found in the job, and it was like the investigative microbiologist that goes out to the companies and stuff. And so I was able to get that detail. So I got permission from my director. She's like, sure, you can seek out a detail. And so I sought it out, and I was waiting and waiting and waiting. And I was like, what happened? So I called them. I was like, hey, I said, I put in my application for the detail. They were like, oh yeah, we accepted you, but your supervisor denied it. What?
Thanks for listening to this episode of Don't Be Scared. We hope you found this discussion valuable, helpful, and informative. You can reach us through our website, social media, or by leaving a review on your favorite podcast platform. 5 stars, y'all. And don't forget to check out our resources and services at Don't Be Scared, where we help organizations and individuals pursue their dreams